You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Alex Bellos. I'm the author of a couple of math books, Alex is Adventures in Numberland, Alex with the Looking Glass. I also talk about math on the radio and have a blog in The Guardian, etc. And it's a huge thrill for me to welcome you all to the RSA for today's special lunchtime talk. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, Cédric Villani. The RSA has invited Cédric here today as part of a new series of talks aiming to enrich our understanding of creativity and featuring creative pioneers from a range of fields and disciplines. So we open the series with a mathematician and a very special one. Cédric is professor at the University of Lyon, director of the Poincaré Institute in Paris, and winner of the Fields Medal, one of the highest international honours in mathematics and indeed in all of science. Cédric's fantastic book, Birth of a Theorem, tells the story of the journey towards that honour and offers a unique insight into where creativity comes from and the roles of passion, focus and partnership in producing breakthrough moments in the progress of human knowledge. And if you haven't read the book, I urge you to do so because it's fantastic. And I don't think there has been a mathematician at that level with as much insight and eloquence on the printed page. So it really is a kind of fantastic contribution to the kind of popular science or sort of science genre. Okay, that's enough of me. Without further ado, please welcome Cédric Villani.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Alex, for the great introduction. And Alex and I have been in contact ever since the time of the Fields Medal, since he was one of the very first to interview me. Now, today's subject is about creativity, and let's put this in perspective with the problem of mathematical ideas and mathematics. And let's start by recalling an event which most of you probably did not take notice of, but that we mathematicians noticed is 2009 when the Wall Street Journal decided to do a ranking of every possible job there is on this planet or anyone that they could think of. And what came first was not trader or princess or whatever, was mathematician. And here was the picture of the beautifully happy, smiling mathematician contemplating his dreamy world of equations, while the poor lumberjack is in the back, is down and looking very sad. Why is it that mathematician is so well ranked in this kind of in the kind of exercises? Well, there is something to it related, of course, to the rise of computer science, intelligence technology, information technology, and all that, which makes it that mathematics has an enormous role to play now and in the future as a job which is ubiquitous, which can adapt to any possible problem in industry, in economics, and so on. And as a job in which ideas is just what we are working on. The job of a mathematician is not to play with numbers, as many people believe. It's not to do computation. It is primarily to assemble the right ideas and to see which idea comes logically as consequence of other ideas. The definition used by the Wall Street Journal was that mathematician is somebody who applies mathematical theories and formulas to teach or solve problems in a business, educational, or industrial climate, which is very good, still misses an important point. It's also about creating new mathematics. It's good to apply it, and it's important that the user world solve problems. Oops, these words, solve problems, because mathematics was created and developed to solve problems and has been doing so for thousands of years. But also it is about creating new mathematics. Every year, hundreds of thousands of new theorems are proven. Each of these theorems is like, a construction of ideas, new ideas coming into the world after careful thought and so on. What is it that will trigger the birth of all these new ideas? This is our problem. This is the problem of mathematics as a science. This is the problem of mathematicians as human beings. As I was saying, we live in this world which is more and more oriented towards information. And it's an important fact that in the world of mathematics, the past and the present coexist. Ideas of the thinkers of the past will be brought to life by present technology, for instance. Here, there is this image from Lord of the Rings, and the equations which are used here to do all these special effects about fluid mechanics are all deriving from the equations which were developed in the middle of the 18th century by people like Euler. I remember attending a big conference about mathematics and applications in which an executive from in charge of the research and development team for some major Hollywood studio was telling to a crowd of mathematicians, "We should pay you guys royalties for every Hollywood blockbuster which is out, given the amount of mathematics that we use." We did not object to this idea for this new source of funding. And of course, we knew that there is all this technology in the world of concepts which is being used so much in current civilization, in current leisure industry, and so on. So that's the picture we have of the world we live in. And as I was saying, the old and the present are together, and there is this big advantage of mathematics, because it's all, by definition, in the abstraction. By definition, mathematics is an abstract science. Even though inspired often by the real world and with many applications to the real world. But because it is abstract, it can make connections between very different real events or real situations. You have to imagine a lot of triggers and a lot of stimulations from the real world coming to the eyes of the mathematician working to think which are the right concepts to synthesize and to understand all these phenomena. And then from these concepts come a number of applications to various facts of the real world. Take the Fourier transform. And this is Joseph Fourier, who was a great mathematician and physicist from the beginning of the 19th century. The Fourier transform, the Fourier analysis, which he developed to understand the variations of temperature in a metal device, have then been used to analyze the songs of the birds, for instance. Whenever you are listening to the radio, listening to music, be it on YouTube or on your iPad or whatever, there is Fourier transform behind. While it has nothing to do with the original use of it, but still, it's related. And whenever images are being transformed and used and processed, it's also Fourier transform that's behind in one way or the other. Here, this is a famous image of beautiful Lina, which is used as a reference by all specialists of image processing. And that's her Fourier transform. A bit less sexy, but very important for use in mathematical devices, in communication between technological devices. And also the same Fourier transform you will find in the medical applications, for instance, when you are going for some scanner, and this is a Fourier transform that the machine is doing of you, essentially. Fourier certainly did not imagine one would make the Fourier transform of some individual. It did not happen so long after the invention, less than 200 years after that. This is nothing compared to the scale of human civilization. And these are the basic ideas are here and engraved into these two so compact formulas. That's the magic of mathematics, representing in a compact space with a few symbols and ideas phenomena and concepts that can be applied to a wide range of phenomena. However, life of a mathematician is not so rosy often as you would think from the previous account. Even though we are on top of the charts, even though we know we are so useful, even though the Hollywood is ready to pay us royalties, at least so they promised, most of our life is spent in failure, trying and trying and failing to prove anything. You know, 90% of the time it's failure, and that's if you're extremely lucky. And I like this picture here, you see, like, gosh, where is the solution going to get from, going to come from? And here it's like I'm waiting for good old Henri Poincaré to whisper in my ear some indication, something. You know, in mathematics, we have so many possibilities also because we are not contrived by reality. We can try anything we can possibly think of. So where will the solution come from? It takes a long time and experience to get sense of orientation. Maybe I have a chance in this direction, that direction, anyway. And other thing I like to remind is, even when you have the right idea, not clear you'll be able to convince your colleagues. In mathematics, it's about not about applications of a device that works, or it is in the long run often, but first you have to convince your colleagues that it's a good theory. Fourier had amazing problems convincing his colleagues it was a good theory. Galois, Abel famously had all these difficulties convincing their contemporaries of the importance of what they were doing. Here I put as illustration an example taken from outside mathematics, tragic example. This is Ignaz Semmelweis, the father of hygiene, guy who was the first to dare say that it was good for a surgeon after practicing, you know, cutting and dissecting corpses before going to give birth to some lady, giving birth to some baby with some pregnant lady. It was good to wash hands in the meantime between one operation and the other. Could save lives. Nobody believed this. Why would you? What is this? My hands are very clean. Look, there's nothing. Of course, what is this stupid, dreamy idea of little bacteria? What the hell is this? And Semmelweis died crazy, we know, after failing to convince his colleagues. Then the science in itself always manages to correct. But it can take time, and at the scale of the individual, it can be a big failure convincing people. Now, the other thing mathematicians and scientists in general have to endure is being asked to predict the future. Wow! So, Professor Virani, how will mathematics look like in 2050? That's a typical question. What the hell do I know? And here comes the way that Henri Poincaré answered this question when it was asked him in 1900s. And this journalist asked, what will be science of the 20th century, Professor Poincaré? And Poincaré answers, sir, monsieur, your letter is coming to me today after some time. If in 1800 one had asked to any scientist what would be science of the 19th century, how much nonsense he would have said, good heavens. This thought prevents me from answering. I believe that surprising results shall be obtained. And that's precisely for that reason that I cannot tell you anything about them. Because if I were to foresee them, what surprise would there remain? So please excuse my silence. So that was the Poincaré answer. I viewed this line several times on radio, on the television. It's good to quote somebody from the past and get out of this predicament of having to foresee the future. And truth is, in this job, as in any other business relying on creativity, artistic business, discovery business, in mathematics, it's all about the ideas, so to speak, but also interaction with the new technology and the new scientific discoveries from other sciences. who can predict its collaborative, massively collaborative process? And it's true. If in 1900 Poincaré could have predicted everything that occurred in 20th century, totally impossible. What happened in 20th century? Is monster? Here are some of the figures from that period, from that century, reminding us of the power of great ideas, the power which they had in reshaping our world and in reshaping the whole history, not just history of sciences, history in general. And let's start with one of the great English heroes, Alan Turing. Of course, there's a movie about him nowadays on screen, but he's been a hero for mathematicians and computer scientists for a long time. Many people consider him the true father of modern computer science, and many people believe falsely that the apple here, the half-bitten apple, is an allusion to the poisoned apple that he ate for suicide. It was asked to Steve Jobs whether this was indeed a reference to Turing, and he replied, "No, but gosh, I wished it were true." So Alan Turing was one of the important actors in Second World War. Total secret. Churchill called his project the goose that laid the golden eggs, the Enigma project, which managed to completely decipher all the secret communications of the Germans. This was a totally vital matter. And it is clear when you read accounts and the story of that period that it would have been impossible to have the Normandy operation in 1944 if it had not been for this work of deciphering. And war would have lasted at least 2 years more. Many, many things could have occurred. And this was just because there was the right team of mathematicians led by Turing, which was able to get this secret code deciphered. See, it takes one brain with the right configuration at some point, can be a considerable influence, can be millions of casualties in plus or minus. To the left of Turing is a person which symbolizes one of the most important events in the story of economics and motions of ideas of 20th century. The exile of the Jews from Europe and the fact that they went to America, where they all started a new era in science. And this was Paul Erdős, only living for ideas, super creative, no home, no family, except his old mother, no car, no job, no nothing, just suitcase and ideas. The most prolific mathematician of the 20th century, more published papers than anybody else. And the symbol of these scientists, emigrated scientists who had lost everything and were only dedicated to producing new ideas. Like this other wandering Jew to his left, Leo Szilard, the first guy who had the idea of atomic bomb. How would the chain reaction be produced? Interestingly also, because it's related to this problem of creativity, Szilard was trying to contradict. He was a guy who liked contradiction, and he had read this statement by Rutherford, father of nuclear physics, saying that, yes, there is some energy in the atom, but anybody who would think of using it would be talking moonshine. And Szilard thought, I will prove this guy wrong. I will find a way to extract a lot of energy from the atom. And at some point, and he says this in his memoirs, waiting for some cross at some pedestrian crossing in some street of London, the light goes from red to green and puff, he has the illumination, chain reaction. That was 1933, and the first human on Earth to have this idea of how to construct an atomic bomb. Later, in the United States, that's him who convinced Einstein to write the famous letter by Einstein to the President of the United States, which started the Manhattan Project. Einstein, by the way, famously said when Szilard arrived with Teller to explain him about the principle of nuclear bomb, Einstein famously said, "Ah, I had never thought of that." Ironic, since many people nowadays believe that it was the idea of Einstein. Anyway, this is the patent of Szilard. This institution here I put as famous institution to emphasize the fact, the most important fact, that a higher education institution is great not because the students received teaching of the best up-to-date science of the day. It is great when the students manage to create science and ideas which are better than that they are told. That's the key problem. That's the key problem, the most important, how to make it that your students will do better than you do. That's the master and student dialectic, and you are training your student so that he can think of things that you never thought of. How to do it, nobody knows, but somehow, in certain circumstances, this gets done. For me, it played a totally crucial role. Alex mentioned my winning the Fields Medal. It could never have been done without the help of my former student, Clément Mouhot. When we worked on the problem of Landau damping in plasma physics, it was an effort that it would have been totally impossible for me alone to overcome. But with the help of my student, who had new ideas, so that our ideas would complement each other, I could do it. And that's the key problem in higher education. Poincaré tells us about moments in which ideas come to you. Because now that we understand these ideas are so important, how are they born? Where do they come from? That's a key point, and nobody really knows. Poincaré talks of this story in which at some point, just climbing to get back on a bus from a hike, he has the illumination of how to solve a certain problem which had been so elusive for days to him. At the very precise moment where he puts his foot on the stair, then came the idea. This is another quote by Poincaré in a famous book, which gives us a lot of information about his way of working. "Disgusted by my failure, I went to spend a few days on the seaside thinking anything else. And one day, while, you know, wandering on the cliff, the idea came to me, always with the same nature, very brief, sudden and immediate certainty, that arithmetic transforms of indefinite quadratic ternary forms are identical to those of non-Euclidean geometry." First remark, once again in this example, we see absolutely no relation between the circumstances and the problem. You know, there are these popular tale of Newton seeing the apple fall down, gravitation, etc., whatever. But here there is no relation between the cliff and the problem, you know. Even if you don't know what is arithmetic transform of indefinite quadratic ternary form, you see there's absolutely no relation to the cliff. So it can strike you at any moment, and that's the power of the unconscious brain. And that's your problem for the creativity, making this your ally. I have seen this in the most striking circumstances, for instance, like waking up after a few, this is an example I tell in the book that Alex was quoting. Imagine spending part of the night trying to work like crazy to solve a certain technical problem of which a whole construction depends, of which for a result that you have already announced that you can solve. For some reason that at the time you cannot understand. Why did I say that I can do this? I'm so stupid. I can't do it. Now you work like 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., doesn't work. You go to bed, you're desperate. In the morning you wake up and there is this voice in your head. Put the second term on the other side and take Fourier transform. Wow, and there it is. So that's the power of the unconscious thinking brain. It's very rare, but sometimes this happens. It's really like a flash, like Poincaré says. Okay, so all this and other things I told in that book, Théorème Vivant, or Birth of a Theorem. Just for the record, my original French title was Naissance d'un Théorème. And then the French complained that it was too explicit and there was need of something a bit more mysterious. And after discussion, I came up with Théorème vivant, living theorem. But then when it came to the English translation, the editors complained that it was a bit too mysterious. And they suggested, why not Birth of the Theorem? I said, okay, why not? Let's do it. Nice illustration of the slight difference of taste from one side and the other of the channel. So anyway, in Théorème vivant, in Birth of the Theorem, that's exactly what I describe, the circumstances. Notice the text by Poincaré. Poincaré uses these fancy words and does not explain them. That's one of the reasons, I'm sure, why the text was so successful. If Poincaré has started in saying, let me explain to you what are quadratic transform, etc., part of the readership would have been lost. But if he puts these big words with no attempt of explanation, people don't try and understand them and just focus on the circumstances. You cannot do everything at the same time. So if you try at focusing on what are the arithmetic transforms and so on, you will lose part of the important thing, the circumstances. And that's exactly what I did in the book. Just the circumstances. How the idea is born, which is the sequence of crazy coincidences, conversations, accidents, mistakes, erring, and so on, which in the end gives birth to the final result of the idea, to the final stage, to the theorem. And all along you see these various assemblage of formulas which look like they are incomprehensible, but you see the transform like some organic, some living creature which is taking form. At the beginning it is the very chaotic state, in the end it is in a very organized state, ready to go in the outside, ready to be published. As at the beginning a human being in the womb is very something that doesn't look to have any structure, and in the end is ready to be born. What are the ingredients which are at work when you have this process of birth of an idea to be performed? I told you nobody really knows how the idea comes to you, but we have quite an idea of which are the ingredients which are needed to make this thing happen. And I will enumerate 7 ingredients which are present in the book, but are present also in any successful story of research that I know of. First ingredient is documentation. Libraries can be electronic libraries, can be physical libraries, but anyway, some ways to know what has been done in the past, because there's no such thing as a scientist doing things from scratch, from nothing. You always build on the contributions from the past, being using the result or using the ideas or using the spirit. It's good to say this in such a respectable old place as this one here. Second ingredient is the motivation. This is the most elusive and the most important at the same time. There are some spectacular examples of remarkably good scientists who do nothing because, well, good in the sense very strong to solve problems, but they're just not motivated. And more generally, people think as motivation as the number one threat of science in Europe. Because if you don't have all the young motivated people doing science, who will do it? That's a key thing. Motivation, it's not clear where it comes from. Immigration, by the way, super duper important in science, in part because immigrants and their sons and daughters and grandchildren are often very motivated people who have to make, to climb the social ladder, and it's no surprise that this occurs. If I look among the, in the past, you know, French have a specialty for Fields Medals. 20% of all the Fields Medals went to us. And among the 4 blast ones, the 4 past Fields Medalists in France, 3 were born outside of France. So immigration is so important, and that's related to the motivation. But motivation can also come from anything. I remember I was watching this animated cartoon as a kid, finding this so fascinating. Donald in Math Magic Land. This is the kind of thing that can impress you for your life. It is known that Turing All his life was influenced by a book that he read at the age of 10, Natural Wonders Every Child Should Know. Thus, the power of education and inspiration at a young age is impossible to overestimate. This at the left is a paper published in Biology Letters and written by a bunch of kids from school together with some researcher. And they devised these experiments, the kids, and found how motivating and fun this is. 10-year-old children having their paper published in a science journal. We discovered that bumblebees can use a combination of color and spatial relationships in deciding which color of flower to forage from. We also discovered that science is cool and fun because you get to do stuff that no one has ever done before. That's the principal finding, and of course, it's been discovered before, but still it's good to publish it again. Third is environment. In any period of life, of the life of the world, let's say, there are some environments which are favorable to birth of ideas, to innovation. Often the city is a good unit for that. And for any example, you know, at some time it was Persepolis, the most innovative city in the world. At other time it was Paris. At some other time it was London. At some other time it was Budapest, and so on and so forth. There's no such thing as isolated mathematician. Creativity needs environment and something that is ecosystem. My job as director of Institut Henri Poincaré is to help maintaining this ecosystem within the walls of the institution. We don't have permanent researchers, but we want the environment to be there, maintained in such a way that the new ideas will come and be created through the contact. The next thing is communication. Environment is the key to have the new idea of the new project. But then when you want to pursue the project, you need the communication. It can be of people from different environments. Most of my work in the birth of the theorem was done as I was in Princeton and my collaborator was in Paris. And we were communicating by email, or every day email and email. And this made it possible for us to work in a very collaborative way. In recent years, Tim Gowers from Cambridge ran some amazing experiments in which hundreds of mathematicians can collaborate together on proving a single theorem. That may be one form of scientific research in the future, or of creative research in general in the future. As in the software industry, we know that three softwares are massively collaborative. The next ingredient, which is so important for creativity, is the constraints. And that sounds as an oxymoron, or it's like a contradiction. But many of the creative people will tell you if you have no constraints, you have no creative ideas, no creation. Because the constraint is what forces you to get beyond the obstacle. In mathematics, these constraints are crazy of having a reasoning that is entirely rigorous. Here are two constraint pieces, which I put to illustrate and also to show that it's not just science, but any creative business. One is this piece by Jurgi Ligeti, in which only A's have been used, like in the scale A, B, C, D, but this is only A's, you see, and still you don't get bored when you listen to it. And this is La Disparition, in which Georges Perec, you know, it's this thick novel without the letter E. Crazy constraint leading to a new way of talking, kind of. So the language in this book resembles no other language because of the constraint. The next ingredient is the mixture of elimination and strong work, you know, meticulous, systematic work, alternating inspiration and meticulous work, as Poincaré has described us. And the final ingredient is the mixture of luck and tenacity. You need luck in order to do things. In the book, there are so many instances in which it looks like sheer luck. But there are ways to help the possibility of luck. And being insistent is one of these ways. Okay, let me use this cool block picture to recall that science is not a linear process. It's a very messy, very tricky process. We learn in school science is theory, experiment, conclusion, theory. Wow, that's not the way people work. The way people work looks like this. Accept challenge, do science, find out somebody does it, instrument breaks, not as expected, amazing results turn out to be crap, what the hell is going on? No, doesn't, yes, yes, oh, I understand, no, this is funny, oh, they figured this out 50 years ago, and this, we start again and again and again, and that's, imagine this, the hundreds of thousands of mathematicians, the millions of scientists worldwide engage in this process, each on their side, but also all together running this in interaction. It's a crazily complicated process. And let's conclude with two beautiful quotes. So far, it was all about the difficulty, all these ingredients to get the idea. So new ideas are something worth treasuring. It's also something which is made for sharing. Ideas are for sharing. This was beautifully expressed by Thomas Jefferson. In those days, by the way, in the text, he blames the English for being so attached to things like copyright, whatever, and is considered a founding father in America. But nowadays, most of the issues about copyrighting ideas and so on are rather on the other side of the Atlantic. So it's very useful to have a quote by Jefferson, because if you have an agreement, an argument with an American, throw Jefferson in his face, he can do nothing. If nature has made any one thing less susceptible than all others of exclusive property, it is the action of the thinking power called an idea, which an individual may exclusively possess as long as he keeps it to himself. But the moment it is divulged, it forces itself into the possession of everyone, and the receiver cannot dispossess himself of it. Its peculiar character, too, is that no one possesses the less, because every other possesses the whole of it. He who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. In those days, politicians spoke very eloquently. And this is for Poincaré, the last word. La thought, la pensée, thought is like a lightning strike in a long night. But it is that lightning which is everything. And that will be the end of it. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions, and then I'll open it up to the floor and we can take questions. We've got 20 minutes or so left. Firstly, Cédric, on the theme of creativity and mathematical creativity, in your book, you say that you have a particular mathematical style. I was wondering if you could maybe expand on that in the way that, you know, artists in other genres also have different styles, and is it that comparative at all? And also, a difference that maybe you have with creativity in mathematics compared to other areas is sometimes mathematics is too difficult. You get to the ceiling of your own thought. I was wondering, do you struggle with that, and is it possible that sometimes mathematics will just get too difficult that you can no longer be creative with it?
With respect to the first question, indeed, each mathematician has a style, and there are the broad styles. An analyst does not think like a geometer, a geometer does not think like an algebraist, and so on. Ironically, up to the age of 20 or so, I was best in algebra, and now algebra is the field that I really don't understand a single word of. So there are these changes in style that can occur. It's a way to think of the problem, to be able to think of certain tools, certain strategies, and so on. And there are also styles like, if you're more at ease, assembling complicated concepts or putting simple concepts together, which, and so on. More elementary tools, more sophisticated tools, and so on. Also the problems, where they come from. They originate from some problem in physics, some problem in geometry, and so on. And so I have a certain style, and I know some problems, they may be within my realm, either not, and even within a certain field. For instance, I worked a lot in fluid mechanics. I'm an expert of gas and so on. But it is all compressible fluid mechanics I can think of. Incompressible is out of my brain, so to speak. I don't have any good intuition about it. So that's about the style. There was the question about difficulty. Sometimes as it gets so difficult that you can't be creative, or that you don't see where the new, you cannot isolate the new ideas. That's the main danger, is when the new idea, the new brilliant thing is all hidden inside an ocean of technicalities. Some people would argue that, for instance, this is what has happened to some branches of mathematics, like analytical number theory, in the footsteps of the Riemann zeta function and so on, which is so damn technical and complicated nowadays. Other people will tell you that it's just an impression and that someday there will be, again in these fields, the bright, simple, beautiful ideas that will make it all progress in a monster way.
Interesting. There's so many different ways we can go there about, you know, the different areas of mathematics. I don't know if any people here, maybe that we're already getting quite technical there. Maybe some simpler questions. I don't know.
Ian Wigston, fellow. You expressed the importance of partnering and selecting partners. Could you tell us something about the process you go through when looking for partners? Do they have to complement your creativity, or should they be in some way quite different from you?
That's an extraordinarily important question, and I cannot also say how it occurs. So first, it's very rare that I collaborated with people from my own institution. And for me, it was always like my institution is for discussions and talks, etc. But the projects were made with people from outside, people from at least 10 different countries. And it was like random process, meeting this guy. Oh, let's do this together. Oh, I have this. I know this. Oh, wouldn't it be nice to do something about this, and so on. And there is often a process like, you know, you are showing somebody to something to somebody. This might help for something. And that person will say, for instance, let's do it together. In one of my early collaborations, there was this German mathematician I had met, Felix Otto, in some conference, and he had this strange formalism that I felt was very interesting. I learned and so on. And a few weeks later, by accident, I am reading this probability treatise by some French probabilists that had been recommended to me, and I see, wow, there must be a relation with the other talk I heard from that German guy. And then I wrote it down. I found the relation in maybe a few minutes. It was very a quick process. And then I wrote to that other German guy and suggested we write the paper together and so on. And it was written. It was just a few days of work for a couple of weeks maybe for both of us. To this day, it is my most quoted paper, which shows, by the way, that the recognition of a paper is not always proportional to the amount of work that you put in it. But it's about having the right partner, yes, and the right problem. And that's really something, there is no algorithm. It works well when there is some complementarity, but still you can communicate and check what the other is doing. In all my collaborations, it never was something like, I do this part, you do this part, we put them together. It was always like each of us goes through the whole thing again. And of course, some parts are first drafted by one of us because that's, I feel better doing this, he feels better doing that. But then we redo the whole process. And this also, my way of working is usually with very intense bonds, collaborations on a quick rhythm. And usually after a very intense collaboration, I don't manage to reconnect with the same partner. It will be a different project with another partner. I had this very intense project with an American mathematician, John Lott, in a field that later became very popular. Now it's booming. We made this wonderful, wonderful work together with very intense. We wrote like more than 100 different versions of the paper before publication and so on. And after that, we are unable to do anything significant. It's something. Sometimes you have this dynamic, and then that's it. It's a one-shot event. Happened to me the same kind of intense bond, also with distance and lot of email, even outside the field of science. I just finished a project of graphic novel with a drawing artist. Here also, it's complementary, but we did a lot of thinking and discussion about the whole, and it was also very intense, like every day, new email and so on.
Thank you very much. If I would have known that you're going to talk about mathematics, I wouldn't have come, because I don't understand this subject. But I really enjoyed it. It made me think that Protagoras thought that in order to reach the soul, we need that abstract concept. That in order to reach that aha moment. Do you agree with that?
I'm less sure. At some point, there is some element of truth in there. You need, at some point, to have the image in you of the concrete thing. The image, by definition, is the abstraction, is a representation of something that applies, that is the real world. And in mathematics, it's all about first making an abstract image of the reality in the world and then working only on that image. It's at that level, at the level of the image, of the abstract reflection, that the thing occurs. And the aha is at that level. To some extent, that is true. I'm always a bit suspicious, though, of the theories of the ancient Greeks about this. They often have these very clear-cut ideas about how it occurs, how things should be done, and so on. And I think usually they exaggerate in being categorical.
In your book, there's a quote by André Weil about the experience of proving and finding mathematics. That's almost a spiritual statement that he says that you seem to obviously like, because you put it in the book.
Oh, it's a sexual statement that he gives.
Sexual, spiritual, it's a kind of...
He gives very concrete analogy and saying it's like an orgasm, except that it lasts longer. But it's more rare in practice.
Maybe if we take three questions and then we can answer three together.
Thank you. I'm Angus Jenkinson. A lot of your talk was about different kinds of contexts and how those different kinds of contexts make a difference. You also talked about specific kinds of contexts, like walking on a cliff face, crossing a bridge. Now, Gregory Bateson was not a mathematician, but he talked a lot about analogies between things. For example, the arrangement of a plant form is analogous to grammar. My question is there any kind of analogous relationship between the circumstances? Is it maybe just as simple as crossing a threshold? A cliff face going onto a bus is a threshold crossing? Or is there some other kind of analogous relationship, pattern relationship, between the situation, the contextual situation, and the subject being thought about? Or do you think it's just random luck?
Thank you. My question's similar, actually. You spend a lot of time talking about the stimulus for an idea, and that, you know, it's like a bolt of lightning. It's maybe not related to the idea. To what extent can that process itself be codified mathematically?
I think potentially you already touched on this a little bit when you talked about the Greeks being too concrete. And this idea of mathematics allowing you to be very compact with an idea. I work in finance, I work in risk. So this whole idea that the map is not the territory and people apply mathematics in the wrong space. This idea around being rigorous in the real world, if you have any thoughts that you could share with us around that, that would be fantastic.
Let's go on with the first is about the analogies. It's true that our brain works a lot with analogies. That's totally true. But with the circumstances of what's going on, there's no rule. Some people will need to be in a different environment so that the new idea comes in. Some people, on the contrary, need to be in the very same environment and to suppress every stimulus from the outside world, as if to better listen to stimuli from the inner world. It is famous that, for instance, a guy like Gauss, who was so amazingly inventive, spent all his life like at home, not moving, and in the same environment. I would not dare to say that it is really luck and uncorrelation, but there is no clear correlation emerging. I quoted the story of Newton and the apple. That's the typical story we would hear of the with analogy and so on, but certainly the story is a legend, and I'm not aware of any convincing repeated pattern that would allow us to give rules. And that brings us to the second question: a mathematical theory of the stimulus and the new thing is quite out of reach for the moment. Misha Gromov, who was maybe the most respected living geometer, said that first problem that we have, the three big mysteries in front of us, are first, understand the guts of the laws of physics. And to the most deeper way, you know, there are all these problems still, like putting together relativity and quantum mechanics and so on. But second problem, understand the life. And third problem, understand the brain. And he would say that these are exponentially difficult in terms of, I say that, but the second one is much more difficult than the first one, and the third one much more difficult than the second one. Now, we now have artificial intelligence, which does take off, which does wonders and so on, but it's not about understanding it. It's about reproducing it. But you know, you can give birth to a son or a daughter, you still don't understand what it is that makes him or her live. And it's about the same with artificial intelligence. We have these techniques, machine learning and so on. They are based on statistics, geometry and so on. To some extent, we understand what they are doing, but to other extent, we don't really understand. They are learning their process by themselves. The third question, completely different, was about the range of application. What is it when you have to be careful about mathematics applied to finance and things like this, and risks? Well, for sure, the mathematical theories of finance, they are based on models, so it's in the abstract world, on models that we know are basically false. You know, you have this theorem: if this and this and this and that are true, then there is this. And in practice, this is false, this is approximately true, this is not bad, and this is completely false. And then you apply it still, hoping that the result will work not too bad. And in general, when the environment is quite okay, when it's stable, it will work not too bad. And then when arrives a period of crisis, it can do dramatic failures. In particular, in the treatment, the problems which are pointed out most often are the independence. Actors in finance are not independent. Most mathematics uses the independence. The fact that also the fluctuations are non-Gaussian, and they all use the assumptions of Gaussian independence, of Gaussian fluctuations, which is related to the independence. So these are two big problems in the modeling. And we know that events that are supposed to be extremely rare from mathematical models do occur much more often. It's because the modeling is not right. Of course, well, there's this joke saying the model is always by definition right and perfect. It is a real world which makes mistakes. And you can always say this. But of course, the stakeholders might not agree if you tell them, you know, the world it started doing mistakes. You cannot, in fields so complicated as economics, of course, be it micro or macro, you cannot hope to have such good agreement as with a field like physics, in which everything works according to law. But it's important, I would say it's not forbidden, to use theories outside of the range of application, just as long as you are aware what you're doing. Like, okay, there's the speed limit, I'm over the speed limit, but I'm aware of it and ready to brake if need be, and so on.
Thank you all again for coming and for great questions. We could have had many more of them, and Cedric could have spoken for hours. Burford Theorem, his book, is available for sale right here outside the auditorium, and I'm sure Cedric will be happy to sign it and maybe answer a few other questions. I think my book might also be there, so if his queue is too busy, you can come to my queue. Anyway, finally, thank you. Please do join me once again in thanking today's terrific speaker, Cedric Villani.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.